From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, in honor of Indigenous Peoples Day, we look back at the history of Native American activism and the issues that continue to impact tribes today.
Plus, why the Oriental Theater is so vital to the future of the Milwaukee Film Festival.
It's something that a lot of filmmakers who come through the city comment on. A lot of cities don't have theaters like the Oriental. Milwaukee does. It's one of the festival's main selling points.
And we'll find out what it is about A Star Is Born that made it right for a fourth version.
So I think the juxtaposition of having your dream come true in one sense, but then also having your love life and your life kind of come crashing down around you, those two stories intersecting, I mean, those are two things that everyone can relate to in one way or another.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. It's Indigenous Peoples Day in parts of the U.S. In others, it's Christopher Columbus Day, a fact that many tribes take issue with, given his crimes against Native peoples, including enslavement, murder, and genocide.
Although Native American history predates U.S. history by thousands of years, many history textbooks condense it to just a few paragraphs. For many, the most prominent moments in that history are Thanksgiving and the Trail of Tears, forced relocations and death marches, which killed thousands of Native people in the 1800s.
But throughout the history of this country, Native people have continued to fight for their rights through battles, legislation, and demonstrations. Heather Briegel is a member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin and a historian and lecturer on Native American activism and policies. She will be in Milwaukee for a lecture on that very topic, and she joins me now. Heather, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This is maybe an odd place to start, but I was really curious. When you first talk to non-Native people, especially, about your work and what you do, how do they respond?
It kind of usually depends on the type of setting, kind of also helps determine how someone reacts to it. But I do really mainly speak to non-Native people. And when I do start talking about especially topics that are not the most pleasant, there is usually some look of resistance that I can see throughout the audience until they realize that I'm not really just attacking non-Native people. I'm just really here to educate you about a certain event or situation. And then the reaction is more of coming from a place of education where they want to learn more and find out more about whatever they can about the Native people in this country. And then usually at the end of it, it's those people who usually have the looks of resistance that come up to me at the end and are usually like, thank you so much for, you know, talking. Thank you. I learned so much. I didn't know this before. I definitely want to find out more information.
Yeah, I mean, you know, personally, there was so much that I really didn't know. What are the kind of misconceptions, misperceptions that you come across when you really start talking to people?
Honestly, legitimately, that we are all the same type of Native when we're really not. We're different. While we're all Indigenous to this country, we are different in our practices, in our language, in our thought processes and feelings. But I think one of the other misconceptions is that I saw this on Facebook actually a while ago, and I thought it was quite funny, but it fit perfectly, that people tend to think of, you know, Indigenous people or Native people, you know, being at one with nature and harmony and, you know, all of the good things. But what they fail to realize is that we are activists as well. We are resisting. We are trying to decolonize. We are trying to embrace our religion again. So while, yes, we do hold nature and Mother Earth sacred, we're out there fighting. And I think that's a big misconception that people don't realize, is that we're out there with you fighting.
That's what so much of your talk is about. When you first start talking about activism, where do you start?
I kind of talk about it in a little bit more of a modern sense, where I talk about the formation of the American Indian Movement in the 1960s. However, one can personally go back farther than that and talk about our activism in sense of like the Indian Wars that happened, you know, when there was fighting that would happen when, you know, the United States was trying to expand westward. You know, say you've got the Great Sioux War, you've got the Black Hawk War, you've got Red Cloud War, you've got the Battle of Little Bighorn. I mean, these are all acts of resistance because we were resisting colonization. We were resisting settlers coming out west, and we were resisting, you know, the invasion from the people who were discovering gold. So you can go back farther and talk about that. That could take a semester in college. That's how long it could take. But when I talk about it for an audience, I usually start with the more modern civil rights era movement in the 1960s with the formation of the American Indian Movement.
The American Indian Movement is fascinating. And when you talk about AIM and when you talk about the larger movement, I can kind of remember learning about that in high school history class, but it was maybe a few paragraphs in a textbook. It wasn't something that we really dug into the same way that we dug into the civil rights movement, but it did have a similar impact just on the Native American community.
Right, and you have all of these movements happening at such a volatile time in our country. I mean, in the 1960s, you have the overall civil rights movement happening. You have the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You have the Voting Rights Act of 1965. You have, you know, second wave feminism happening. You have the LGBT movement happening and the rise of, you know, Harvey Milk and LGBT rights. You've got AIM, the American Indian Movement happening. You've got, you know, laborers, Chicanos, all of those movements happening at one time. To be personally honest, I don't actually think I remember in high school, now I went to high school in Michigan, but I don't remember hearing anything about the American Indian Movement. It probably wasn't until I got to college, and even then it was maybe just a paragraph or so, like, oh, this was happening too, by the way, but like an afterthought of the main civil rights movement going on.
Yeah, I can remember the image, which is, I think, why I remember it. In my textbook, they had an image of protesters, I believe, on Alcatraz, which you also mentioned in your speech.
Yes, I think we probably remember the same image.
It's an iconic image, yeah.
Absolutely. And yeah, Alcatraz, I think, wow, they held that for over a year. They held Alcatraz Island for over a year. And that was a culmination of all tribes coming together. It started with 80 people, and at one point, there was well over 200 people on the island. So that was pretty awesome in a way to bring, you know, awareness to the breaking of treaties and land being stolen and wanting an area just for, you know, us to embrace our culture and to be able to really feel like you could be free in a certain area. So, you know, when I first read about Alcatraz, I thought that was fascinating.
I'm speaking with Heather Briegel. She is about to give a lecture over at the Milwaukee Public Museum about Native American activism and policies. And, you know, really, when you get into all of this, it's such a deep history in our country. Where you started, at least in the lecture that I was listening to, was with President Andrew Jackson and the Indian Removal Act and, of course, the Trail of Tears. And I think that's where a lot of people often stop when it comes to Native American history. They stop at this really dreadful death march. Our perceptions around that, at least my perceptions, were that, yes, there was activism. Obviously, there was fighting, but I didn't recognize how much legal activity was going on even then and how much it has continued today.
Yeah, absolutely. When I do talk about policy, I do start with, you know, Andrew Jackson, good old friend to the Native Americans, who was instrumental in basically making sure that there weren't any Native tribes in the southeastern portion of the United States. Thousands of people moved, thousands more died. It was just absolutely ridiculous. And then to find out how through amendments and through bills and through the Constitution, they were able to do all of this stuff and, you know, force us to move. And then what's really, really interesting is when I do talk about policy even more, and even for my own personal education and knowledge, as I was researching things, it didn't dawn on me that Native Americans, we were not considered citizens of the United States until 1924. And I was doing the math And it dawned on me that my grandfather was 13 before he was considered a citizen of the United States. In the land that he was born in the country that he was born in, he wasn't considered a citizen officially until 1924. And that is absolutely insane. So it's no wonder why they were able to, why while these policies and the government were able to get away with things for so long, because they could. We weren't citizens, so they could govern us however they wanted.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about Andrew Jackson closer to the beginning of Donald Trump's presidency. And he has made it very clear that he is a fan of Andrew Jackson. When you hear politicians like Donald Trump, like some people in the GOP, praising President Andrew Jackson, how does that make you feel? What do you think of?
Oh, God. I think it was last year where it was either last year or earlier this year, to be honest, it's all kind of blending together. But Donald Trump held a ceremony in the White House. I feel like it was in the Oval Office, and he was honoring some Navajo code talkers. And in the background was a portrait of Andrew Jackson. I lost it. I lost my cool. And I'm wondering, I mean, you know, anything about politics, it's all a game of optics, how things are perceived. And it was kind of like he was backhandedly honoring these veterans, these Navajo code talkers, with a portrait of Andrew Jackson looming over them. And, you know, the grace and dignity to which these veterans handled that situation was amazing. But to not understand the history behind that man, behind Andrew Jackson, to not understand the genocide for which he's responsible for, and, you know, the stealing of land and the stealing of homes, the stealing of lives, I mean, it's appalling. And to hear politicians, to hear the President of the United States and others in his party praise him, it baffles me, along with everything else going on in the country right now. It absolutely baffles my mind that you can, you know, sing the praises of a man who governed over such a dark time in our country. It's the same way I don't understand why people praise Christopher Columbus. It's the same concept. I don't get it. I mean, these men were not great. And I think that's one thing that we do in history is we try to, you know, sugarcoat it. And I don't sugarcoat it. And I don't feel like I need to, because I feel like the history speaks for itself. And the history says Andrew Jackson was not a good man. So it really hurts my heart. It hurts my spirit when I hear people sing his praises.
Understandable.
Yeah.
You know, looking at the Trump administration and looking at Native American activism today, there are a few things that the administration has proposed and some things that they have set in motion that really do harken back to this long history of struggle, really, with United States policies. What are some of the things that have come up in, you know, the last couple of years that activists are really fighting against?
Well, again, I think first and foremost at the front lines is the stopping of pipelines. When we thought we had a small victory during the Obama administration, when he halted the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline and basically Keystone Pipeline as well. And then Trump is elected and he comes into office and he immediately signs those into work, all in the name of progress and in creating jobs, not fully understanding, or probably in his case, not caring that he's actually destroying land and destroying sacred, you know, burial sites. The Dakota Access Pipeline goes straight through some burial grounds, you know, that are important and sacred to the Standing Rock tribe and the other Sioux and Lakota tribes in the area. It's important. They might not be land that belong to them, you know, through treaties, but I mean, they are lands that are important. So first and foremost, the stopping of pipelines, the protection of our water, not just for Native people, but for all people. Here in Michigan, we have our own issues with water, with our Flint water crisis, with Line 5 going through the Straits of Mackinac. There's water shutoffs in Detroit. Our students in Detroit public schools don't have clean drinking water right now. because they just found lead in their water, just like they did during the Flint water crisis. So water, of course, is first and foremost the protection of our Mother Earth. Another issue that I know that has come up within Native communities is also the issue with our missing and murdered Indigenous women. There are no statistics that are held on us, so we don't know how many are missing and gone and never to be found again. And that, I think, comes with how complicated investigating crimes on reservations can be. It's so intricate and so complicated on because we're reservations are technically under federal jurisdiction. So do you call the state police? Do you call the local police? Do you call the FBI? Or do people even care that, you know, our Native women are going missing? Another issue is I just read not that long ago that the Trump administration, one of the things that they want to do is they want to, so we're classified as sovereign nations, and that's how we're recognized to the U.S. government, but they want to reclassify us as a race as opposed to sovereignty, and that affects funds that we get for health care for our tribes, for our nations, for our peoples. A lot of people, a lot of our elders, you know, rely on those health care benefits that they get from the government, and if they reclassify, you know, Native Americans, that affects that as well. Another issue that's going on that just came up, the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, which is the tribe that you learn about during the first Thanksgiving, they actually just lost some land that was supposed to be put in federal trust for them. So they were already in the process of developing this land. They were going to create a new casino, I believe a museum, some educational areas as well. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is under the Department of the Interior, took that land away. So now there's a fight for that because if it's a possibility that the federal government can take land away from one tribe, they can eventually end up taking it away from all of us. That threatens our sovereignty. I mean, there are so many issues that I think that people aren't aware of that happen in Native country that are equally as important to the issues that are happening to the general population right now.
Yeah. Well, Heather Briegel, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, and thank you for sharing your work.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me. You know, anytime I can share our history or a little bit of what's going on in our community, I'm always up for that.
Heather Briegel is a historian and lecturer who will be in Milwaukee tomorrow for the lunch and lecture series at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Briegel is also at the Racine Public Library tonight in celebration of Indigenous Peoples Day.
A quick break now, and then some insight into the 10-year history of the Milwaukee Film Festival and some tips if you plan on going this year. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The Milwaukee Film Festival opens in less than 2 weeks. This year's festival marks 10 years in its current incarnation, and the first which will feature a renovated Oriental Theater as home to Milwaukee Film.
Before audiences can see this year's selected films with their popcorn handy, writer and Milwaukee Magazine cultural editor Lindsay Anderson joins us for a history lesson on the festival and a revealing look into the people who made it happen, the subject of a feature in this month's magazine.
Anderson joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to share the story of the festival. She starts by explaining how the East Side Theater figures into Milwaukee Film's success.
Well, the Oriental Theater, I think, has always really been the crown jewel. It's Milwaukee's grandest movie palace. It's just a beautiful venue. It has three historical auditoriums. It's something that a lot of filmmakers who come through the city comment on. A lot of cities don't have theaters like the Oriental. Milwaukee does. It's one of the festival's main selling points. So it makes sense that the festival would be interested in having a little bit more control over programming in the space. It also makes sense that the festival would just want a venue of its own in general. In past years, they've had to work with theater owners and sort of work around their schedules to figure out how to slot the films in for the festival. And I think the theaters are generally excited to work with Milwaukee Film, but they have their own concerns as well. And those
it's
are
a lot of time
take,
commitment,
yeah,
too.
Those are going to take priority for them, too. So this just frees Milwaukee Film up to devote one of the biggest, most beautiful theaters in the city to the film festival and just really set the stage for that experience.
Well, and it really does make the film festival a different experience when you go to this film palace that was designed as, you know, a form of escapism from
right.
the world versus, okay, let's go see this international film, say, at a Marcus Theater. It's not going to have
right, absolutely.
As much impact.
It's an entire experience. You go in, there's chandeliers, there's those lions sculptures, the Buddhas with the glowing eyes, it's just being in the theater itself is part of the experience and being in the audience and seeing the other people there. So I think that's definitely one of the highlights.
Yeah. And with the Milwaukee Film Fest, they also do a good job of incorporating other local theaters across the city to fill screens. But I want to harken back to kind of the first big film festival here in Milwaukee.
Sure.
And that was the Milwaukee International Film Festival in 2002 that was kind of shepherded, or I suppose that's a good word,
shepherded
by the Shepherd Express. Can you go into a little bit of the history behind that effort?
Yeah, absolutely. So Louis Fortas, who is the publisher and now also editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express, realized that at the time, Milwaukee was actually one of the largest cities in the country without a major film festival of its own. And people here, you know, love the arts. They're interested in film. He thought it was strange that we didn't have a film festival of the caliber of a lot of other cities in the country. So he decided to set out to create that festival. And he figured, I think, that because the Shepherd runs so much arts and entertainment coverage, that they were sort of uniquely positioned to launch that festival.
Yeah, and so they focused on films that specifically could break down barriers and educate audiences about the wider world, which I feel has been still a consistent theme.
Absolutely. It would make sense to point out, too, that I think the first person they hired was Jonathan Jackson. They reached out to him early on. That was something he was interested in as well. And then, so even when the Shepherd stepped away from the festival and it became a Milwaukee Films project, Jonathan Jackson was still there. He was still interested in promoting these international films by up-and-coming young auteurs.
Can you explain the somewhat tumultuous transition of Milwaukee International Film Fest under the Shepherd to Milwaukee Film under that new leadership?
Sure. And I should say, to start off with, that the character of the transition, I think, depends on who you talk to. So how Fortas will describe it is different than how Chris Abele or Jonathan Jackson would describe it. But essentially, I think everyone agrees on the idea that the Milwaukee International Film Festival quickly became a pretty big audience success. It grew every year. More and more people attended the festival every year. But it had a very small board. There were only three people on the board. They were all Shepherd Express employees. And, of course, all of them had additional full-time jobs at the Shepherd Express. So there was some concern that the festival was sort of outgrowing its roots and that it was becoming too big for this three-man Shepherd Express board to manage. And then, depending on who you talk to, Fortas and Abele either were able to somewhat amicably hash things out initially and were talking through a transition and through this idea of having the Shepherd step down and hand over control to Milwaukee Film, or they weren't amicably talking and there was like a little bit of a bitter feud there. And that led to Fortas filing a lawsuit against Chris Abele, who ended up creating a separate 501c3 nonprofit called Milwaukee Film and sort of founding his own film festival with Jonathan Jackson's help that was separate from the Shepherd Express.
And a lot of other Shepherd Express employees who were involved in the international film also followed into Milwaukee Film. So do you think people maybe will view Milwaukee Film a little differently after learning about this background story?
Well, maybe. I mean, I will say, I think Milwaukee Film is one of the most successful, interesting nonprofits in this city. I don't think anyone thinks they aren't doing great work. And I think even back then, all of the people involved, they did what they did because they wanted the festival to be as good as it possibly could be. So there's like a clash of egos, but I didn't get the sense that people were fighting just for the sake of fighting. They all cared about the film festival. They just had very different ideas of what direction it should go in and how to make it the best possible festival. And Louis Fortas and Chris Abele definitely disagreed about which direction they thought it should go in. So, yeah, I guess I would just say that.
Did Fortas mention what he thinks now of the way the direction Milwaukee Film has gone in?
He did say he's very proud of the fact that he sort of paved the way for the current incarnation of the film festival. And he did specifically also mention that he was particularly proud of the fact that he was able to bring so many international films and filmmakers into the city. I mean, I'm assuming a little bit here, but I think he would still be pleased to see that that is still a hallmark of the Milwaukee Film Festival as well.
Well, it certainly helped pave the way for the sustainability of the Oriental as well.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. That's another thing. Yeah.
One of the key players involved that you mentioned is Jonathan Jackson. So what was his role back in 2002 that they brought him on?
They brought him on as a programmer. At the time, he was working for the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee with their theater programming student films there. And from what I hear, he was doing a wonderful job. It was before I moved to the city. But from what I hear, he drove up attendance numbers. He had a great mind, A, for programming, but B, for kind of marketing and figuring out how to bring people into the theater and get people excited about the films. And he was just great at being able to fuse those two skills.
One thing that I enjoyed finding out was that he had his own history in the Oriental Theater, and he used to work there, you know, cleaning up after midnight screenings of, you know, the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So the Oriental has been a big part of his life, and now it's kind of reached that culmination where he is running the building and what it stands for. So how has that kind of relationship with the theater influenced his decisions and how Milwaukee Film is operating?
Well, he told me when I interviewed him that his first night in Milwaukee, he moved here from Cleveland actually to study film at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. His first night in the city, he, you know, didn't have anything else to do. Classes hadn't started yet. So he wandered over to the Oriental Theater to catch a screening, I think he said, of Darren Aronofsky's Pi, and immediately fell in love with the space. So I feel like in some sense you could really say that he's had this ongoing love affair with the Oriental Theater from literally day one of his time in the city. And from what I hear, a lot of people who work for Milwaukee Film have sort of had gotten the sense that the Oriental was something he had sort of always had his eye on. He loved the theater. It really is Milwaukee's grandest movie palace. He also really wanted Milwaukee Film to have its own venue. So it sounds like he was always just sort of hoping, waiting that they might be able to put a bid in to lease out the theater.
One thing that I think makes not only Milwaukee unique, but Milwaukee Film is its commitment to hosting the events in these old theaters. And as of August, the Oriental reopened under Milwaukee Film with some new renovation projects. So one very exciting thing is that the new women's bathroom is in the base. Eight stalls, I counted. So, and things like, you know, they're doing this in stages, but they're repairing the plaster in the ceiling.
Right.
They put in a new screen, new sound system to have a good blend of modern tech so that you can enjoy the film to the best of your ability, but still keep that escapism, all the decoration, everything that makes the Oriental what you look for when you go for that experience. And with the lease signed up to 2049.
Yep. 31 years.
Yeah. What can we expect or what has been hinted at by Milwaukee Film of its plans for the Oriental to have this leadership for this much time?
Yeah, well, I mean, like you said, they've already been hard at work modernizing the theater. I think maybe it's important to say, too, they intend to keep this theater aesthetically essentially the same it's always been. Everyone loves the way it looks. They have no intention of, you know, ripping down ornaments or changing up the decorations. I also think that we're going to start to see more interesting programming happening there. A lot of people don't realize that Milwaukee Film doesn't just put on an annual film festival. They also work on year-round programming. So now that they control the Oriental year-round, I think we're going to start to see smaller film festivals popping up at the theater, too. They already had a motorcycle-themed festival pegged to Harley-Davidson's 115th anniversary earlier this year. I think we're going to see more things like that. And I think we're going to see more films made by Milwaukeeans and Wisconsinites, too.
Well, and that seems like it's also a goal of Jackson and Chris Abley and other people who have invested a lot into the Oriental Milwaukee Film is to make Milwaukee a hub for not just film viewing, but filmmakers.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the BRICO Forward Fund has been instrumental in doing that. Over the last few years, they've started awarding these grants, significant grants, $50,000 grants, to aspiring and budding filmmakers in the city and the rest of Wisconsin. And that's the kind of thing that can make and break your career, really. I mean, if you're given those kinds of resources early on and that kind of encouragement, I mean, that can take you as high as you want to go, really. And I think we saw that, too, with last year's centerpiece screening, The Blood at the Doorstep. That was made by a Milwaukee filmmaker, and he received one of those grants. So I think it just goes to show how much of an impact they can have.
Milwaukee Film and the festival already has a pretty strong fan base, I would say. But what are the efforts in bringing in everyone in Milwaukee to be excited about projects like these, you know, outside of our film festival season?
Yeah, well, I think they've done a good job in the past creating special programs like Black Lens to sort of bring in different groups who might not have known too much about the organization before and sort of spotlight programs and films that are of particular interest to certain segments of the population, certain communities. And I think they're trying to do even more on that front this year. They've announced several new programs, including one, I think it's called Genre Queer, to sort of highlight LGBTQ experiences in film. They're also launching one that spotlights German cinema and another that targets teenage viewers to teen screen. So I think they're always just sort of really thinking about how they can pull in new audiences and maybe shine a light on films that are of particular interest to those communities, and then also set up sort of panel discussions and events surrounding those film screenings to get people excited about those, too.
It seems like through your interviews with people like Jonathan Jackson and Chris Abley that their intention is to not just make Milwaukee Film a Sundance caliber, but keep it Milwaukee-centric. Because we know that Sundance is a massive film festival. A lot of people go there just for the films. But it seems like their focus is about the city year-round and
yeah,
wanting to raise its status, but yet still keep that first community-centric mind that was there since the International Film Festival. What did you learn about these people that you interviewed for this story? Did anything surprise you or stand out?
Well, I think one of the most striking things that Chris Abley said, and that also rang true for me, is that I think as Milwaukeeans, we have a tendency to undersell ourselves a little bit. People here like Milwaukee, but they're not quick to assume that we can put on the same caliber of festival that Sundance can. You know, I think that we have this sort of idea that we're just sort of a mid-sized Midwestern city. We can put on good festivals, but we can't put on great or amazing ones. And he says no to that. And also, I think he pointed out that Summerfest, you know, now is the largest music festival in the world. And the reason it was able to become that successful and get that big is because when people were told, hey, this is Milwaukee, you can't shoot for first best, they were just like, no, we can. We can do whatever we want. We can put on a world-class festival here. There's interest here. People support the arts here. We can absolutely do it.
All right, Lindsay. Well, thank you very much, and I look forward to this year's Film Fest.
Thank you.
Lindsay Anderson is cultural editor at Milwaukee Magazine. The October issue includes a feature on Milwaukee Film's 10-year history, as well as some helpful film festival tips. You can find a link to the magazine's website from WUWM.com.
One film out well before the festival is the newest iteration of the classic A Star is Born. Film contributor Ryan Jay offers his take on the fourth edition of the story when Lake Effect continues on WUWN.
More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's not too often that the fourth time is the charm in anything, but actor and first-time film director Bradley Cooper hopes his version of the classic movie A Star is Born is indeed a charm in its fourth version.
The first one came out in 1937 and starred Janet Gaynor and Frederick March. It told the story of a film star who fell in love with an aspiring young actress, helping her find fame even as alcoholism sends his life downhill. The story changed a bit with the 1954 remake starring Judy Garland and James Mason. The characters were singers instead of actors in the 1976 version, which starred Barbara Streisand and Kris Kristofferson.
This newest version features Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga in the leading roles. Lake Effect film contributor Ryan Jay talked with Audrey Nowakowski about how the most recent iteration of A Star is Born holds up to its predecessors and why filmmakers keep reviving the story.
It's the Hollywood tale that the business just won't let die. You know, it seems to reinvent itself. And whenever there's a leading lady or in this case, an up and coming leading lady with Gaga, it's a showcase for that talent because it has chops for your acting and for your singing ability. And I mean, there's no one greater when it comes to classic singers in history than Judy Garland and Barbara Streisand. And so now to add Lady Gaga to that list, which seems appropriate because it's harder to stand out today as an artist in the world of social media and one-hit wonders and not career artists anymore, but Gaga certainly is that. And she had a great break in acting in some films and also doing a great arc on one of Ryan Murphy's American Horror Story seasons. And so, she and Bradley Cooper met and made this happen, and it's another masterpiece.
Yes. Now, when we first heard rumors about this being remade again in the modern era, it was supposed to be under the direction of Clint Eastwood with Beyoncé starring. And as much as I love Beyoncé, honestly, after seeing this version, I don't think they could have done this story as great of justice. In my opinion, it was the first remake I've seen in a long time that puts the heart and soul of a story back into the cinema.
Sure. And it really was Beyoncé interested in doing it. The studios, Warner Brothers and MGM, really wanted Beyoncé for this. She had some scheduling conflicts. Interesting that Clint Eastwood was attached at one point because Bradley kind of was inspired to do the project while working with Clint on American Sniper. And Bradley has said that Clint is his greatest influence as a director. Bradley wanted to be a director even before becoming an actor. And then, he did Bradley Cooper was in that TV show Alias with Jennifer Garner back in the 90s. And then he has a couple of his Alias co-stars that make some appearances, and he must have called up some friendships and been like, hey, I'm directing. Come out and have fun on set for a day. So those are kind of some Easter eggs looking for those actors in this film.
Yeah. We're going to hit back with this latest version, but let's start with some historical context. So first off, it was a book, and our first screen adaptation of A Star is Born is in 1937. What's kind of the backstory of who's in there? What's made it stick out? Because this is the first big storytelling of this.
It's true. Well, that one I hadn't seen, but that one was Janet. You saw that one, so you can speak to that one. It was Janet Gaynor who played Esther Blodgett. Vicki Lester, this character changes her name when she becomes a star. And then Frederick March was Norman Maine. And those same names are retained for the 54 version with Judy Garland and James Mason. But why don't you tell me, how was that version? I never saw that original version.
Yeah, so I think it's gives you the old Hollywood movie nostalgia because the formatting is more straightforward. It's more direct. You have a little bit of a quicker transition from here's a woman living in Nebraska with her family who dreams of Hollywood, who goes to the movies wanting to be an actress. And then, her grandmother encourages her to go to Hollywood. And then similar concept, randomly meets this great actor and stumbles upon this story. But what I find interesting compared with the first three versions compared with this one is how almost, and this is my perspective as a woman, but how unlikable almost the co-star is, you know, and how brash and aggressive they are at trying to get the attention of their leading lady, you know, mm-hmm. and how this forms into a, quote, relationship, a romantic relationship that
leads
to marriage. It's
true. If we look at those, you know, the three versions I've seen, and then now in this original fourth, the first, you look at them, it seems that the male character softens up with each version.
Yes.
I think in listening to you talk about that, what I realized is maybe what the magic is with the story of A Star Is Born and why it renews for new generations is because it's two classic stories. First, you have the dreamer who wants to make it in Hollywood or in music, you know, either at the Oscars or the Grammys. And, you know, there's that bit in all of us that's the dreamer of going and becoming a star, you know, and have it and kind of being that one in a million, that diamond in the rough who actually makes it, right?
Yeah.
So you've got that going on, which appeals and talks to everyone. And then also speaking to everyone is the harsh reality of actually finding true love, being in the relationship with the love of your life, and having it crumble and having it have moments of pain and difficulty and challenge and the realities of how difficult relationships are. So I think the juxtaposition of having your dream come true in one sense, but then also having your love life and your life kind of come crashing down around you, those two stories intersecting, I mean, those are two things that everyone can relate to in one way or another because everyone's been through a breakup, everyone's been through a difficult relationship or had difficulties in a great relationship. And then everyone's always also had a dream.
Mm-hmm. That is a very good point. And this film, in the character of Norman Maine, whichever iteration it is, most often deals with alcoholism, with mm-hmm. addiction. I feel like the latest version kind of deals with it in a more modern way, including other, you know, drug abuse and other things like mm-hmm. that. But let's jump to the 1954 version, which I think can stand out pretty tall amongst these four.
Yeah.
With Judy Garland, of course.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge Judy Garland fan, as The Wizard of Oz is my favorite film, and I love her. And I think that this is one of her best films. It's up there with The Wizard of Oz and Meet Me in St. Louis and Easter Parade. This was a comeback for Judy. She made movies really consistently in several movies a year and then took a 4-year break, which was one of the longest breaks in her career at the time, and then made a comeback with A Star Is Born in 54 opposite James Mason. And she was up for the Oscar, and it was a huge upset in her career that she didn't win that year, but she did win the Golden Globe, as did James Mason for Best Actor of the Golden Globe. It's sort of a crown jewel. She, I think, was among the most proud accomplishments of her life was that role. But I think that this movie, you know, this version, the 54 version with Judy, really punctuates the main problem that all of the films have had, except for maybe the first one with Janet Gaynor. But Barbara's version, Judy's version, and even Gaga's new version, they're all a little too long. They're all,
I agree.
I think Judy's version was
over 2 hours.
2.5 hours. Mm-hmm. Barbara's was 2 hours and 20 minutes. This new one is 2 hours and 15 minutes. And I
first think, one was the classic hour and a half.
Yeah. So it's like, I think that there's maybe too much concert or performance footage in each of them, a little bit of a drag in terms of the relationship aspects. So I think that the last three versions, including this new one, could have lost 25 minutes easily.
I absolutely agree with you. And that particularly stuck out with me with the 1976 Barbara Streisand, Kris Kristofferson version.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's natural because Barbara also produced it, you mm-hmm. know, so she's absolutely in all her rights to include more footage of basically
herself?
Her singing, you know. And with Judy, that was also a big difference between the original and Judy's, was that she's not just an actress. Now mm-hmm. she's a singer.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, we need to make time to showcase
performance.
Judy's performances.
Mm-hmm.
But with the 1976 version, while it was, you know, a great reinterpretation of the story, it was, in my brain, it was a live Barbara Streisand concert with some
Absolutely.
Film.
Absolutely. You're right.
You know?
You're right. It was. And it was, I think it's maybe the weaker of the versions. And because there's less context and story happening during the concert footage. And Barbara's great. And, you know, she's the kind of singer that you could listen to just forever and not stop and not get sick of that voice. But it was that Barbara period where, you know, it was the curly-haired rock version of Barbara. So it's not as, even though she won the Oscar for writing Evergreen, Best Original Song, and that absolutely deserves it. I almost wanted more of that song in that version. And apparently she wore her own clothes in that film
Excellent.
Too, which is
okay.
kind of fun. Like, it's credited. There was some, like, controversy that, I guess, in the credits, it's actually, like, Barbara's clothes from her closet. And it was, like, that was, like, a problem for some people. I have no idea why.
Yeah.
But more power to you, Babs.
Right.
And she's phenomenal. I mean, I've never seen her do any film or any performance that hasn't been dazzling. But again, it lagged. It definitely lagged.
It lagged. But I really think Kris Kristofferson is the underrated performer because he brings a new softness to the opposite male lead that the other two did not have. And now we also have he's not just an actor. Okay, he's a fellow musician. And while I feel like his rock, you know, he's kind of like the Bob Dylan of rock in this movie, and that juxtaposing with Streisand's like 1970s disco tech kind of like singing, for me that clashed in my brain to have these two such different styles, which maybe also added to how long you feel that film goes.
It's true. One thing that I think is interesting was the Barbara version was the one that turned a corner where, you know, the first two were about actresses going to the Oscars, and then the next two, Barbara's and Gaga's, they're singers and they go to the Grammys in their films. I kind of personally like them going to the Oscars. I like the character of the girl being the star, being born as an actress, an actress who sings. But, you know, I guess appealing to audiences today, maybe it made more sense to go with the singers and the Grammys.
Yeah. So now let's dive deep into the 2018 version here. This version is Bradley Cooper's directorial debut. So he's directing, he has a writing credit, and he's also starring in it. Mm-hmm. But I think he brings back that sensitivity to all aspects of it. What were your impressions of this film? I honestly have no complaints. I feel like this is definitely like near the top of these versions.
Oh, absolutely. It is my favorite, A Star is Born, which is saying something because I am such a Judy Garland fan and love her movies and wish she was still around making more movies. But yeah, I agree. This is the best version of this story, just maybe because it's more accessible and because it's more modern. And so it's more our generation. Gaga is phenomenal. She pays homage to Judy Garland in the film very early on by singing the verse of Over the Rainbow that was originally that's cut from The Wizard of Oz. So it's nice having that in there. So we've got some Judy in there. We've got some Barbara in there in the sense that this Bradley Cooper version is co-produced by John Peters, who is the executive producer of Barbara's version, actually dating Barbara Streisand during the making of that film. So, you know, we have Judy's blessing, we have Barbara's blessing, and then we have the full force of today's star power with Gaga, who's at the top of her game. She's going to get nominated. She may even win for this. Certainly the Golden Globe, maybe the Oscar. Bradley Cooper, surprising everyone, is a great director. I'm sure he had some great guidance, but where he maybe didn't have as much guidance but just blows you away is his singing voice.
Yes.
And they sang live. This is the first movie musical to come out. Granted, it's more of a movie with music than a classic musical, but it's the first movie with music and performance this way to come out with live singing since Les Mis a few years ago.
Which was met with murky water perception. Yes.
So like, but they are phenomenal. I mean, Gaga is uncontested as a singer. Mm-hmm. Bradley's proving himself, but like, come on out with your album. Where's your singing career now, Mr. Cooper?
Yes.
I'll line up for that CD.
Well, one of the first thoughts I had when this movie ended was like, I wonder when the soundtrack is going to be available.
Yeah.
Because we also have music credits, I believe, by Willie Nelson's son.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
who taught Bradley how to play guitar for this?
Yeah. So you really see the work and the way these two styles meld. You know, it wasn't a conflict of music like I felt it was in the 1976 version.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw little inklings of how Lady Gaga is in her live performances.
Right.
If you've seen her or if you've watched any of her performances on a music award show or her interaction with the audience that she is classically known for and makes a point to do, you know, having that intertwined with her amazing ability to take herself back to that first moment when she's like on a big stage
and
for
you
the
believe
first time
it. You
and you're baffled by it.
Yeah,
you
how
know?
Can the biggest star, one of the biggest stars in the world, on par with Beyonce, Lady Gaga, you know, the rest, whoever is as big as they are right now, to watch her naturally behave and perform as though she's nervous and intimidated by a crowd is remarkable. I mean, that's where it's award worthy.
Yes.
She is acting and it's real. But also, just their chemistry is phenomenal. I mean, it's palpable. You feel them and you're rooting for them and you believe everything about their relationship. So they just hit home runs there.
Yeah, which I feel makes you a little more invested in their development throughout the film, and also makes I don't think I'm doing a spoiler alert here. There's four versions over the past how many years. The male lead dies always. But I feel
it's not
like,
a spoiler when it's the fourth remake. Come
exactly.
On.
If you haven't seen this by now,
yeah,
go get busy.
He's going to die.
Yeah, he's going to die. But I feel like the way they handled it in a more modern situation, mm-hmm. having not only his addiction problems, but also the effort to make himself better and mm-hmm. to go to rehab, but to have this relapse in a sense, I feel put a better connectivity to modern day audiences who perhaps are not familiar with any of these versions beforehand.
Right.
You know, we're going to have some older audiences that are most familiar with Barbra Streisand's version.
Mm-hmm.
But for the quote millennials and anyone 18 and under seeing this, mm-hmm. they're not going to perhaps connect to these other versions as well. So I feel like this had a great balance of adding more weight to the problems that this film addresses.
Absolutely. And you still, even though I knew what was coming because I've, you know, seen the previous ones, you're wondering how and why, and you're waiting to see the reactions and how Gaga's character is going to happen to her. She's Allie in this movie. That's
yeah.
the only thing. I don't remember why they named her Allie.
Yeah.
You know, we had Janet Gaynor was Esther, Vicky, and the same with Judy, Esther, Vicky. Barbra was Esther, and suddenly we've got Allie. All right, I guess, you know, Esther might just be a very dated name by now. You're still, even though you know where this film is going, you still are wondering how it's going to get there. And so that kind of hooks you also.
Exactly. And I also love the tributes to the versions past. You mentioned there's the song for Judy. There's Barbara's producer and approval. But there's also lines and scenes.
Oh, yeah. There's
throughout
one
all
iconic
four.
One. Yep.
Just want to take another look at you.
Yeah,
you
in
know?
Every single one. I love that they kept that.
Yes.
It's in the trailer and it's in the movie and it's a great homage and a great through line for all these.
Yeah, so I think we can both say we strongly recommend that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm definitely going to get the soundtrack. I will be, you know, writing this down on my short list. You know, as I think we will be for the awards shows that we
definitely
vote for.
Oscar nominations. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, at the very least.
For sure.
All right. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, too.
Film critic Ryan Jay is a nationally syndicated radio host and resident reviewer on Channel 4's The Morning Blend and Saturday News, and also one of our film contributors. A Star is Born is out in theaters today, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.